nutrients and toxic inedible sap. Its roots were the most at risk, smothered and vulnerable within a blanket of rotting plant tissue. The cost of maintaining these defenses came out of my tree's meager savings that were intended for happier uses. Each drop of sap was a seed that didn't happen. Each thorn was a leaf that wouldn't be made. In 2013, my tree made a terrible mistake. Assuming that winter was over, it stretched its branches and grew a new crop of lush needles in anticipation of the summer. But then an unusual May brought a rare spring blizzard, and a copious amount of snow came down in just one weekend. Conifer trees can stand heavy snow, but the added weight of the foliage proved too much. The branches first bowed and then broke off, leaving a tall, bare trunk. My parents euthanized my tree by cutting it down and grinding out its roots. When they mentioned it on the phone months later, I was standing in the dazzling sunshine, living more than 4,000 miles away in a place where it never snows. I think of the irony that I fully appreciated that my tree was alive only just in time to hear that it had died. But it's more than that. My spruce tree was not only alive, it had a life. Similar to, but different from my own. It passed its own milestones. My tree had its time, and time changed it. Time has also changed me, my perception of my tree, and my perception of my tree's perception of itself. Science has taught me that everything is more complicated than we first assume, and that being able to derive happiness from discovery is a recipe for a beautiful life. It has also convinced me that carefully writing everything down is the only real defense we have against forgetting something important that once was and is no more, including the spruce tree that should have outlived me, but did not. Chapter 3. A seed knows how to wait. Most seeds wait for at least a year before starting to grow. A cherry seed can wait for 100 years with no problem. What exactly each seed is waiting for is known only to that seed. Some unique trigger combination of temperature, moisture, light, and many other things is required to convince a seed to jump off the deep end and take its chance, to take its one and only chance to grow. A seed is alive while it waits. Every acorn on the ground is just as alive as the 300-year-old oak tree that towers over it. Neither the seed nor the old oak is growing. They are both just waiting. Their waiting differs, however, in that the seed is waiting to flourish, while the tree is only waiting to die. When you go into a forest, you probably tend to look up at the plants that have grown so much taller than you ever could. You probably don't look down, where just beneath your single footprint sit hundreds of seeds, each one alive and waiting. They hope against hope for an opportunity that will probably never come. More than half of these seeds will die before they feel the trigger that they are waiting for, and during awful years every single one of them will die. All this death hardly matters, because the single birch tree towering over you produces at least 250,000 new seeds every single year. When you are in the forest, for every tree that you see, there are at least 100 more trees waiting in the soil, alive and fervently wishing to be. A coconut is a seed that's as big as your head. It can float from the coast of Africa across the entire Atlantic Ocean and then take root and grow on a Caribbean island. In contrast, orchid seeds are tiny. 1,000,000 of them put together add up to the weight of a single paperclip. Big or small, most of every seed is actually just food to sustain a waiting embryo. The embryo is a collection of only a few hundred cells, but it is a working blueprint for a real plant with root and shoot already formed. When the embryo within a seed starts to grow, it basically just stretches out of its doubled-over waiting posture, elongating into official ownership of the form that it assumed years ago. The hard coat that surrounds a peach pit, a sesame or mustard seed, or a walnut shell mostly exists to prevent this expansion. In the laboratory, we simply scratch the hard coat and add a little water, and it's enough to make almost any seed grow. I must have cracked thousands of seeds over the years, and yet the next day's green never fails to amaze me. Something so hard can be so easy if you just have a little help. In the right place, under the right conditions, you can finally stretch out into what you're supposed to be. After scientists broke open the coat of a lotus seed, Nelumbo nucifera, and coddled the embryo into growth, they kept the empty husk. When they radiocarbon dated this discarded outer shell, they discovered that their seedling had been waiting for them within a peat bog in China for no less than 2,000 years. This tiny seed had stubbornly kept up the hope of its own future while entire human civilizations rose and fell. And then one day this little plant's yearning finally burst forth within a laboratory. I wonder where it is right now. Each beginning is the end of a waiting. We are given exactly one chance to be. Each of us is both impossible and inevitable. Every replete tree was first a seed that waited. Chapter 4. The first time I performed an experiment that wasn't a rote classroom exercise, I was 19 and I did it because I wanted the money. I must have held 10 different jobs while I was an undergraduate at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. For the entirety of the 4 years that I was there, I worked 20 hours a week and much more than that during the breaks, earning money to supplement my scholarship. I worked as a proofreader for the university's press, a secretary to the Dean of Agriculture, a camera person for the long-distance learning program, and a machinist polishing glass slides. I taught swimming lessons, fetched library books, and ushered rich people to their seats within Northrop Auditorium. But none of it compared with the time that I spent working in a hospital pharmacy. A girl from my chemistry class recommended me for a job in the university hospital where she worked. The money was good, she said, and they let you work 2 8-hour shifts in a row, earning time and a half during the second shift. Her boss hired me upon introduction, and after a disconcerting lack of scrutiny toward my credentials, I found myself the proud possessor of 2 new sets of turquoise scrubs. The next day I showed up after classes at 2:30 in the afternoon, ready to work the 3-11 shift. I would be working in the basement of the hospital, within the main pharmacy that housed, sorted, and generally kept track of every medication administered to every patient in the hospital. It was a huge facility all its own, with an information desk, a delivery dock, and several storage rooms, including cold lockers kept at a range of low temperatures. It was built around an open-floor laboratory that seemed the size of a warehouse, full of people mixing made-to-order prescriptions needed for the more complex therapies that were happening all over the hospital. The deputy pharmacist in charge explained to me that I would start as a runner, hand-delivering intravenous pain medications to the nursing stations where they were needed. In those days, a doctor had to request medication by writing a paper prescription, which was then personally escorted to the hospital pharmacy. Within the pharmacy laboratory, a tiny amount of pure painkiller was injected into a floppy bag of fluid and immediately swaddled in a thick cloak of paperwork that required both a signature and a time stamp every time the bag was transferred between hospital workers. After the formula and the amount of drug it contained were double-checked and signed off on by a professional pharmacist sporting a PharmD degree, the pharmacist's equivalent to the doctor's MD, the bag was handed to a runner who signed it and then walked the bag through the hospital and handed it directly to the nurse in charge of the patient, who signed it again and then presumably administered the treatment. After drop-off, it was the runner's duty to check the station's outbox for any other MD orders and, upon finding any, to carry them back to the pharmacy. It thrilled me that my signature was required to advance what I saw as an urgent process, and this ushered in a rich fantasy life within which I was routinely relieving suffering, saving souls, and generally preserving the dignity of life all around. Just like every girl who has ever once earned an A in a science course, I had been encouraged to go to medical school, and I began to consider it, hoping against hope for a whopping scholarship of some kind. My job as a runner allowed me to roam every hallway of the hospital and learn the idiosyncrasies of how each nursing station worked, although the majority of my trips simply navigated the well-traveled route between the pharmacy and the hospice ward. I learned to work through long hours that were unbroken by social interaction, save a signature and a look. Although I was surrounded by other people, never dimming light and humming machines, I worked in isolation and was no more disturbed by all the activity than I was by my own breathing. I also discovered that I could set my subconscious to work on a specific task while my conscious mind was occupied with performing workday rituals. During my interview for the job, I had looked longingly into the main lab where so many technicians worked industriously, filling and injecting needles, scrutinizing vials, and unwrapping sterile tubes. I had asked the pharmacists what they were making. "Mostly antiarrhythmics, heart attack stuff," she explained. The next morning, I told my English professor that the topic of my term paper would be The Use and Meaning of Heart Within David Copperfield. The high that I was riding after my declaration began to wear off as I immersed myself in flipping the pages back and forth, cataloging what turned out to be hundreds of instances of heart, hearty, heartfelt, and other derivatives within the first 10 chapters of the book alone. I decided to restrict my paper to a treatment of only the most significant instances. This approach backfired when I hit the following within chapter 38. What I cannot describe is how, in the innermost recesses of my own heart, I had a lurking jealousy even of death. I thought about it and thought about it, but I didn't get anywhere. Finally, 2 o'clock rolled around and I had to go into work. That night in the hospital, I walked in and out of the hospice ward 10 or 20 times, and my eyes and hands moved through the necessary tasks. Well into the night and deeper in my brain, it came to me that as hospital workers, we were being paid to trail along behind death as he escorted frail, wasted bodies over difficult miles, dragging their loved ones along with him. My job was to meet the traveling party at its designated way stations and faithfully provide fresh supplies for the journey. When the weary group disappeared over the horizon, we turned back, knowing that another agonized family would be arriving soon. The doctors, nurses, and I didn't cry because the bewildered husbands and stricken daughters were crying enough for all of us. Helpless and impotent against the awesome power of death, we nonetheless bowed our heads in the pharmacy, injected 20 milliliters of salvation into a bag of tears, blessed it again and again, and then carried it like a baby to the hospice and offered it up. The drug would flow into a passive vein, the family would draw close, and a cup of fluid might be temporarily removed from their ocean of pain. When my hospital shift ended, I found that I could go home and write pages and pages. While in contrast, sitting in front of the computer for hours before work had yielded nothing. I memorized the difficult passages from the book, and then let my subconscious work out their meaning while I was at the hospital. Every hospital worker was required to take 3 20-minute breaks during each 8-hour shift. But runners were also requested to coordinate and stagger them, so that if things got unexpectedly busy, we would be down only one person at any given time. This policy forced me to manage the timing and extent to which I could wander through my own thoughts, and I developed a fine control over my ability to re-emerge. I could work with my brain in my hands for hours, move it into my head for 20 minutes, and then shunt it back into my fingers, in the same way that I could slosh water back and forth in a half-full bucket. I spent my breaks in the tiny courtyards that nestled among the hospital's buildings, luxuriating in the natural light and unrecycled air. One morning I was lying on the grass, with my legs elevated, counting the cigarette butts on the ground while trying to drain some blood back into my upper body. The early sun was striking edgewise on its gables and lattice windows, touching them with gold, and some beams of its old peace seemed to touch my heart. I recited from Chapter 52. I saw my supervisor peer around the courtyard wall and then motion for me to come inside. For a moment I was terrified that I had lost track of time, until my watch told me that my break still had 5 minutes left in it. When we got back to the pharmacy lab, both my supervisor and the PharmD were looking at me seriously. "Why don't you leave out the front door when you run a controlled sub bag?" one of them asked me. "Because I go and use the back stairway." "But you can't get to the walkway that crosses over to the hospice tower from those stairs," my supervisor argued. "You can if you cut through the cafeteria loading dock." "So you never use the elevator?" The PharmD looked puzzled. "It's a shortcut, and you never have to wait," I answered. "It really is quicker. I've timed it, and I mean, there's somebody up there in pain waiting for this stuff, right?" My supervisors looked at each other, rolled their eyes, and returned to their other tasks. It was only partly true that I had developed this route in order to cut my delivery times. I was also compelled to keep moving in order to burn off the endless energy that I possessed at that age, which seized me in ferocious spurts, keeping me awake for days at a time. Hospital work gave me a place to be and a mission to accomplish, complete with repetitive tasks that helped to constrain my racing thoughts. Near the end of the afternoon shift, it never failed that some runner would call in sick, giving me the option to work the night shift if it looked as if I wasn't going to sleep anyway. Sooner or later I would go home at least exhausted if not sleepy, comforted by the night's companionable wakefulness, and a full paycheck richer in the bargain. The shells and pebbles on the beach made a calm in my heart, I remembered from Chapter 10. Plus, I was doing something important, or so I had convinced myself. About a month after I had explained my delivery routes, I walked into the pharmacy, and the PharmD turned and called out, "Lydia, she's here." She then turned to me and explained, "Lydia is going to train you to shoot bags." And just like that, my career as a runner was over. Lydia stood up from her post and cast a sideways glance at the boss. The look on her face didn't exactly congratulate me on my promotion, but I sensed that Lydia's training was a necessary hurdle positioned between me and a big fat raise. "Come on back and take a load off," Lydia yelled in her gravelly voice, more to annoy the PharmD than to welcome me. I got excited and my heart leaped with a new hope of pleasure, to quote Chapter 20. Instead of delivering the bags of intravenous medications, I was going to make them, and then hand them over to someone else for double-checking and delivery. I pictured myself sitting down at my own workstation and adjusting my stool to the perfect height. I pictured myself walking importantly back and forth, from the stock table, picking out exactly the right little bottles of concentrated drugs, in the same way that a rich woman confidently seizes upon the perfect shade of nail polish before her manicure. I saw myself take my position, sit up straight, square my shoulders, and begin to work my magic, calmly but quickly, because, after all, someone's life was at stake. "Here, pull your hair back tight," Lydia interrupted my daydream by dangling an industrial rubber band in front of my face. "And you better get used to yourself without makeup. I bet you think that I look like this hell all the time," she mused with a grim smirk. Loose hair, nail polish, jewelry, none of these were allowed in the pharmacy, as they presented additional surface area that might harbor contamination. And so I adopted the frazzled natural look that you so often see in hospital staff, and I have kept it to this day. The employee pool was about evenly split between pre-professional students and career technicians, but I didn't fit in with any of them. Like the students, I had classes and exams to worry about, but like the techs, I worked way too much because I just needed somewhere to be. Lydia was what was called a lifer within the pharmacy laboratory, which meant she was already there when anyone queried had been hired. While I stowed my backpack, Lydia notified our supervising PharmD that she was going to teach me the differences between the drugs in the stockroom, where they were shelved according to their chemical formulas. I was only mildly surprised when she walked right past the stockroom and toward the courtyard instead. Lydia was famous for two things, her breaks and her rides. She would take all of her breaks during the first 90 minutes of each of her 8-hour shifts and attempt to smoke the 3 packs of cigarettes that she would have consumed across 8 hours had they been leisure time. Smoking 60 cigarettes in 60 minutes requires no small amount of concentration, and even though it was easy to locate her in the courtyard, she was generally too occupied for conversation. During the second hour of her shift, Lydia was extremely alert and productive, but it was generally wisest to give her a wide berth about 5 hours later, when any perceived slight could really set her off. During the last 20 minutes of her shift, even the pharmacists avoided her as she sat stiffly watching the clock, clutching a sterile needle in her shaking fist. It seemed out of character, but if you were female and worked a shift with Lydia that ended at night, she would insist on giving you a ride home. An incoherent string of snarls about asshole rapists was the only explanation that we ever got for her strategic generosity. It was hard for me to picture these rapists, dressed for the 20 below weather and circling the hospital in a holding pattern until 11 p.m., when a fatigued herd of nursing student prey would stagger into their hunting grounds. But in that part of the country, we didn't have the kind of Januaries where you turn down a ride for any reason. Once released from the gas chamber of secondhand smoke that also served as Lydia's car, you had to strip off your scrubs in the hallway in order to prevent your apartment from smelling like the coal miners' union hall for a week. Lydia never drove off until she saw you go inside and flash the porch light on and off. Blink it more than once if somebody needs their balls ripped off, she instructed us maternally. She did not replace my mother. No one could do that, but she came into a vacancy in my heart which closed upon her, I remembered from chapter 4, and smiled to myself. When, during my first hour in the pharmacy laboratory, Lydia and I got to the courtyard, we sat down in the metal chairs at one of the outdoor tables. She pulled a pack of Winston lights out of the fold of her sock and thumped it 3 times on the heel of her hand. She slid the pack over to me as an offering, and lit her cigarette with the communal lighter that was kept chained to a branch of a little birch tree that was serving hard time planted in cement. Lydia put her feet up and took a long drag with her eyes closed. I played with her pack of cigarettes, first shaking them out and then reloading them, although I didn't smoke. In my eyes, Lydia was ancient, which meant that she was probably about 35 years old. At least 34 of those years had been hard years, I figured, given the way that she carried herself. I suppose that Lydia had also been unlucky in love, since she perfectly fit the type who would be sitting at a kitchen table, nursing a coffee cup full of gin while waiting for the kids to come home from school, had she been blessed within a matrimonial union. Chapter 36 said it better than I could. She gave me the idea of some fierce thing that was dragging the length of its chain to and fro upon a beaten track and wearing its heart out. To my surprise, Lydia was also curious about me and asked me where I was from. After learning the name of my hometown, she responded, "Yeah, I've heard of it. That's where that big hog kill is at. Cripes, you crawled right out of the armpit of the Midwest, didn't you?" I shrugged, and she continued, "Well, there's only one place worse than that, and it's the frozen shithole up north where I grew up." She threw a smoldering butt on the ground, looked at her watch, and then lit another cigarette. We passed the next 5 minutes in silence. Finally, she exhaled and said, "You ready to go back?" I shrugged by way of answer, and we both stood up. "You just do what I do, okay? I'll go slow. It'll be fine," she said, and thus concluded my formal training in pharmaceutical medicine. I still didn't have a crystal clear idea of how I was to assemble a sterile mixture of medications that could be injected into a desperately sick person's vein, but I guessed that I would pick it up as I went along. Sitting next to Lydia and carefully mimicking her actions didn't turn out to be a bad way to learn sterile technique, which is more like dancing with your hands than it is like making something. The air through which we walk, both outdoors and inside our buildings, contains plenty of tiny organisms that would feed quite happily on our insides, but don't usually bother us because they can't get close enough to our juicy parts, such as our brains and hearts. Our outer skin is thick and whole, and any openings, such as those for our eyes, nose, mouth, and ears, are coated in protective slime and wax. This also means that every needle in every hospital might be the winning lottery ticket for a lucky random bacterium who, after recovering from the initial rush of an injection, finds himself swishing along within a jolly river of blood until he disembarks in some quiet cul-de-sac of the kidneys, perhaps. There he will breed and also produce one bumper crop after another of toxins that are all the harder for us to fight because they were produced near our organs. The bacteria represent only one hostile faction, with viruses and yeasts capable of their own similar modes of destruction. A sterile needle represents our best defense against such an onslaught. When a nurse gives you a shot or draws your blood, it's a relatively quick puncture, in and out, and afterwards your skin closes over and reestablishes multiple firewalls against re-entry. Your caregiver ensures against bacterial stowaways by using a syringe with a pointed tip that's been sterilized and then sealed into a protective plastic cap. She rubs your skin with rubbing alcohol, isopropanol, in order to cleanse your outermost layer of any bacteria that might otherwise get shoved into your body during the injection. When you are given an intravenous medication, it's a little different. The nurse cleans your skin, inserts a needle, and then leaves it there for hours, effectively making the needle, the tube, and the entire bag that is attached to it an extension of your vein. And all the liquid in the bag becomes an extension of your bloodstream. She will hang the bag over your head in order to encourage fluid to flow from the bag into you and not vice versa. And she'll activate a pump to very gently force it in if the doctor recommends it. The entire contents of the bag will mix with your bloodstream, and any excess from the two pools will be stored in the overflow chamber that is your bladder. Under this configuration, a bacterium now has a lot more territory in which to ready itself for action. It's not just the tip of the needle that could harbor infection. Now it is the entire inner surface of the bag and tubes, not to mention the fluid itself, an expanse more than 100 times larger than that of the syringe alone. Of course, this means that the entire apparatus must be kept sterile, but it also means that everything that has ever touched the whole mess, while the medications were added and mixed, and even before that, when the chemical ingredients were synthesized and stored, must be kept sterile at each step along the way. The great thing about an IV is that it allows your doctor to deliver medicine to your body quickly and for a sustained period. During cardiac arrest, your brain doesn't have a couple of hours to wait around for oxygen while your heart stands in a long queue behind your stomach and intestines, hoping for its share of the medication to seep out of the pill you somehow swallowed. So how to combine a liter of fluid with active agents, customized according to the patient's weight and status, while keeping everything sterile? If this is for the ER or the ICU, we have about 10 minutes to make it happen. Fortunately for the patient, there is a sleep-starved teenager apprenticed to a chain-smoking barmaid in the basement who is ready for action. The first step is to create a clean workspace. Although it's hard to picture, bacteria, yeast, and other tiny things can be removed from air by forcing it through a mesh with holes that are 300 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. When I make intravenous medications, I sit in front of a wall that blows air through the mesh and toward me. The area between me and the wall, therefore, is a clean space where sterile items can be opened, mixed, and resealed. The first thing I do after I pull on gloves is to liberally wash down my entire work area using a spray bottle of isopropanol, bathing the counter and my gloved hands over and over and wiping with tissue after tissue. I leave all surfaces damp with isopropanol, knowing that the sterile airstream will dry them, mainly by blowing it straight into my face. I go to the teletype and select a medication order in the form of a 2-inch by 2-inch sticker, upon which is typed the patient's name, gender, and location, and a code that specifies the mixture of medications required. I pick out a sealed bag of fluid, which has the approximate shape and feel of a packaged pork loin, from the pile produced by the tech who is pumping bags, filling them by the liter with either normal saline or Ringer's solution, a weakly sugared saline named after Sidney Ringer, who in 1882 found that he could make a dead frog's heart beat by repeatedly bathing it in this very formula. Reading the medication order, I pick up the bag, peel the backing off of the sticker, and attach it to the top side such that the text will be upside down when the bag hangs and drips into the patient. I carry the bag to the stock table and pick up the concentrated drugs that I will need, and I restock my own personal stash of the ones that I use very frequently. These drugs come in little bottles with rubber-stoppered tops, color-coded for quick recognition. The tops are crimped shut with aluminum, and the glass and metal sparkle in the unrelenting brightness of the lit laboratory. Some of the bejeweled bottles are indeed precious, containing only the tiniest drop of liquid protein concentrated from the bodies of heroic human donors or hapless animal subjects. Each of these miniature glittering bottles contains a day, or perhaps a week, of frustration for a ruthless tumor. Perhaps just long enough for an ill-remembered animosity to thaw into a critical goodbye. Or so I fantasize while I work. Returning to my workstation, I place my materials in front of me, in a straight line across the front of the bench. I set the bag of fluid that I will inject down on my left, careful to point the site of injection toward the panel of blowing air. The upside-down sticker is now facing toward me so that I can read it. And I widely space the medications from left to right in the order that I will inject them into the bag. Beside each bottle, I place a syringe sized to accommodate the amount of the drug specified on the sticker. I double-check the entire setup, left to right, comparing the words on the sticker with the words on the bottles, one after the other, the first three letters of each word only, in order to prevent wasting the time it would take to read the whole name. I take a deep breath and grab a stack of alcohol wipes, the kind ever so slightly foiled within their tear-open package, as is my preference. I steady my hands, reach around the bag, and pull the seal off of the injection port that faces away from me. I raise an alcohol wipe in front of me, tear it open, and bring it down in front of the bag. I clean the rubbery port that the needle is to penetrate and swab the wipe up and back, careful not to let my hands pass between it and the blowing wall. Then I clean the first bottle of medication the same way, using a different wipe. While turning the small vial of medication upside down with my left hand, I pop the cover off of the syringe with my right hand. I clutch the item securely but strangely in order to keep my fingers to the back, as if I was exposing each item to some holy light. I draw the exact amount of medication printed on the sticker into the syringe, making sure that my eyes are level with the fluid line so that I do not misread the number of milliliters that was measured. I pull the bottle up and off of the syringe by flexing the muscles in my left hand, careful to simultaneously relax the muscles in my right hand in order to avoid losing a drop of medication out of the tip of the needle during separation. I set the bottle down carefully and move the needle up and over the front of the bag. Then I inject the medicine into the bag and toward me. I move the needle up and out, and it is instantaneously useless. I position the syringe's plunger back at the level of medication that I injected and set it down empty on a tray outside my workstation. I carefully seal the bottle of medication that I just injected and then place it on the tray just to the right of its syringe. I do this until I have used each bottle and thus completed the recipe. Then I carefully reseal the bag with a plastic cap and lay it across the same tray, on the side facing away from the needles. I take off my gloves, pick up a pen, and sign my initials in one corner of the sticker on the bag, assuming partial responsibility for I don't know what. I place the tray in the queue that is serviced by a senior PharmD, who methodically double-checks every label, every syringe, and every bottle to ensure that the bag contains what was ordered. If a mistake is found, the bag is discarded, the sticker is reprinted, the whole thing is now a rush job, and a lifer intercedes. It doesn't matter that this is my first day in the laboratory. There are no practice bags. There is just doing it right or doing it wrong. While we work, we are watched to make sure that we don't preferentially draw out the simpler orders from the teletype, and that we use up the entirety of each bottle of medication before we open a new one. We are constantly reminded that any mistake we make could kill someone. The number of medication orders far exceeds what we can complete by the time they are needed, and we are constantly behind. The more people who call in sick, the fewer of us are in the lab working, the faster we have to work, and the further behind we get. There is no time to discuss the fact that this horrible, horrible system is not working, or to assert that we are neither criminals nor machines. There are only endless medication orders given by other exhausted people with nobody better than us to depend upon. Working in the hospital teaches you that there are only two kinds of people in the world, the sick and the not sick. If you are not sick, shut up and help. 25 years later, I still cannot reject this as an inaccurate worldview. Lydia was magnificent at her workstation, possibly because she'd been doing this 60 hours a week for almost 20 years. Watching her sort, clean, and inject was like watching a ballerina defy gravity. I watched her hands fly and thought, in an easy amateur way and without any book, he seemed to me to know everything by heart. From Chapter 7. On that first day, I witnessed her shooting at least 20 bags, sometimes with her eyes closed. I never saw her make a mistake. I was certain that she worked while in some kind of a trance, as there was no way that her brain could have been sufficiently oxygenated. One of the worst things that one can do is sneeze or otherwise spray bodily fluids into a sterile space. And Lydia, for whom the very act of exhaling was basically a cough, exhibited breath control that was positively superhuman while mixing medications. Within my first couple of hours at my workstation, I had successfully made a few bags of simple electrolytes, and the supervisor had started pressuring me to pick up and shoot some of the more difficult orders, because the lab was running severely behind. I tried an order for a simple benzo bag, but then panicked after I injected the sedative, knowing that if I had somehow injected more than I thought I did, I could be curing the patient's anxiety with much more finality than anyone expected. Terrified as a trapped animal, I actually considered bluffing my way through it, putting the bag on the tray in the queue, and then moving on with my life. But I came to, and all at once realized just how crazy that instinct was. I took the bag over to the sink, sliced it with a scalpel, and dumped its contents down the drain, while the PharmD gave me the evil eye. I walked back to Lydia and suggested that we take a break. I don't think I can do this, I confessed when we got to the courtyard. This is the most stressful thing I've ever done. Lydia chuckled. You're making way too much out of this. Remember, it ain't brain surgery. Yeah, brain surgery's on the fifth floor. I completed the joke that the runners told each other at least 5 times a day. Still, what if I just can't get it? I groaned. Half the time, I don't remember if I did something right or wrong. Lydia looked around and then leaned forward and spoke. Listen, I'm going to tell you something about sterile technique. She leaned back and continued in a low voice. Now, don't go licking the needle or anything, but if you've got something on your hands that's going to kill them, they're going to die anyway. I had no answer for that, and Lydia seemed to think that she'd explained what needed to be explained. And so we sat in silence while she smoked. After a while, I rubbed my temples and said, Man, I've got a headache. Lydia, don't you ever worry about what breathing all this alcohol is doing to our lungs? Lydia had a cigarette hanging out of her mouth at the time, and the look she gave me showed that she now had proof that I was terminally stupid. She took a long, long drag and then answered while exhaling, What do you think? Right after we got back from break, I threw myself into the fray and drew out an order for a complicated chemotherapy bag, determined to make good on what was left of my first day in the laboratory. I made the bag accurately and was very proud of myself until an enraged PharmD walked up to me and held a tiny bottle of precious interferon an inch from my face. You just wasted this entire bottle, she hissed with fury. A few minutes before that, I had injected the valuable immunity promoter and then removed the bottle from my workspace without sealing it, thus contaminating the remainder of the supply. In one stroke, I had wasted at least $1,000 of the medication and also created a big paperwork problem. I felt a rush of shame such as I hadn't experienced since I was a little girl getting caught reading on the wrong page by yet another teacher who was sick and tired of dealing with me. As the protagonist of my own private Chapter 7, I looked up with a flush upon my face and remorse in my heart. Lydia, smelling opportunity, stepped in and assured the steaming PharmD, She just needs a break. She hasn't had a break all day. Come on, kiddo, let's go. She led me to the courtyard, and we commenced our umpteenth break for that very shift. When we got there, I sat down and put my head in my hands. If I get fired, I don't know what I'll do, I said, hiccuping as tears threatened. Fired? Is that what you think? Lydia cackled. Jesus, relax. I've never seen anybody get fired from this hellhole. In case you haven't noticed, long before people get fired, they quit. I can't quit, I confessed with anguish. I need the money. Lydia lit a cigarette and took a long drag while looking at me. Yeah, she said sadly. You and me are the type that can't quit. She waved her pack of Winston lights toward me, and I declined for the sixth time that day. When Lydia dropped me off at my apartment later that night, I asked her what she sat and thought about during those long hours when we worked silently in the pharmacy. She considered the question for a moment and then answered, Mac's husband. Let me guess, I ventured. He's in prison? He wishes, she snorted. Bastard lives in Iowa. As we sat there and laughed at a joke that's as old as Minnesota itself, Chapter 7 echoed in my head. Miserable little dogs, we laugh, with our visages as white as ashes and our hearts sinking into our boots. When the medication orders slowed down in the pharmacy and I was tired of sitting, I would go and visit the blood bank to see if they wanted me to carry some pints over to the emergency room. This afforded me the opportunity to burn off some energy, since there was always a lot of time for pacing while waiting for the number and type of blood units to be verified repeatedly by all parties. The lifer who worked the 3-to-11 shift behind the counter was named Claude. And while not as ancient as Lydia, he still qualified as a senior citizen in my eyes, having arrived at the ripe old age of 28. Claude fascinated me, both because he was the only person I'd ever met who had been to jail, and because he was easily one of the most harmlessly nice guys I'd ever known. His hard life had left him physically the worse for wear, but he didn't seem to harbor any resentment, and I suppose this was because his attention span was so short and shallow. Working the blood desk was hands down the easiest job at the hospital, Claude had boasted to me with a sort of confused pride. Claude explained that there were only three things that he had to remember how to do: thaw blood, check blood, and dump blood. Claude began each shift by wheeling several pallets, each stacked high with brick-like bags of frozen blood, out of the deep freeze and into the +5-degree room to thaw. Immediately after it was donated and processed, the blood had been frozen and stored, and now it had to thaw slowly in order to be usable. By moving the blood, Claude was preparing the stash that would be available for use three shifts hence. The next thing Claude did was to man the counter for about 7 hours, waiting for someone to come down with a blood order. Before signing anything out, he had to check and double-check the blood type on the bags against the order form, and sometimes call the operating theaters to double-check. He explained to me that there were at least 4 or 6 different types of blood, and that sending off the wrong type could waste it by killing somebody, and it troubled me that the two consequences were not entirely discrete within his mind. When Claude slammed down the limp, yellowy bags of blood plasma in bundles of 3, I couldn't help but think of the butcher shops that lined the main street of my hometown, and particularly of the meat counters where Mr. Knauer wumped down whatever my mother's note requested before sending me back home to help administer dinner to my family. Near the end of his shift, it was Claude's job to discard any unused thawed bags, which amounted to gallons and gallons of blood, down the hazardous material chute, where they would be incinerated along with the rest of the day's medical rubbish. It seemed a waste to me, and I commented on what a shame it was that good-hearted citizens had gone out of their way to donate the blood that he was heaving by the armload into the dumpster. "Don't feel too bad," Claude said with genuine sensitivity. "It's mostly just bombs doing it for the cookie." The guys at the blood bank were infamous for hitting on pharmacy runners, so I wasn't particularly flattered when Claude developed a crush on me. "When I heard that bunch of ambulances come in, I started hoping that I would see you down here," he told me one day when I arrived with an order, prompting me to mention my fictitious art student boyfriend, whom I had mentally rendered in detail for use on just such occasions. "If you've got a boyfriend, why are you working here?" Claude asked, and it dawned on me that his understanding of the relationship between the sexes was undoubtedly deeper than mine. I made the excuse that artists are generally penniless even when they are gorgeous and wear a sort of troubled look strikingly reminiscent of a certain photograph of Ted Williams at bat during the 1941 All-Star Game. "Oh, so he needs you to buy pot for him," Claude said with what might or might not have been sarcasm, and I couldn't think of a comeback with which to defend my imaginary boyfriend, so I let it slide. I took to working the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift and made a point of being there on Tuesday and Thursday mornings to shoot and then deliver a cart of drop bags to the psychiatric ward. These were saline-based intravenous medications containing a sedative called droperidol to be used as anesthesia during electroconvulsive therapy, known by caregivers as ECT and misunderstood by the public to be shock treatments. Twice a week, patients were readied in the early morning hours and settled onto gurneys, and then lined up in the hallway to wait their turn for the procedure. One by one, each patient was drawn into a quiet room where a team of doctors and nurses administered electrical stimulation to one side of the head while carefully monitoring vital signs. All the while, the patient was awash in the anesthesia I had brought. Accordingly, Wednesdays and Fridays were noticeably better days in the ward, when many of the patients who had previously seemed dead in all but body could be found sitting up, dressed in their street clothes. Some could even briefly look me in the eye. In contrast, Sundays and Mondays were the worst days in the ward, when patients rocked and scratched themselves or moaned while lying in bed, cared for by nurses who seemed both supremely capable and acutely helpless. The first time that I entered through the double-locked doors of the psych ward, I was terrified, believing for no real reason that such places harbored evil souls ready to assault me at any moment. But once inside, I found it to be the slowest-moving place on Earth. And I saw that these patients were unique only in that time had stopped inside their wounds, which were seemingly never to heal. The pain was so thick and palpable in the psych ward that a visitor could breathe it like the heavy humidity of summer air. And I soon realized that the challenge would not be to defend myself from patients, but to defend myself against my own increasing indifference toward them. What originally struck me as cryptic in Chapter 59 was now mundane. They are turned inward to feed upon their own hearts. And their own hearts are very bad feeding. After a few months in the hospital lab, I became really good at shooting bags, to the extent that I could keep up with Lydia and even outstrip her at times. Eventually, the PharmD's double-checking quit turning up errors in my work, and soon afterwards, my confidence ripened into boredom. I challenged myself by developing time-saving rituals for everything from how I lined up my medications to the number of steps I took while walking to the teletype. I studied the names on each label and began to recognize the sicker patients who required the same mixtures day after day. I started shooting the tiny bags that required complicated dilutions, made for infants born prematurely and bearing stickers that read only Baby Boy Jones. Or Baby Girl Smith, where there would otherwise have been a full name. Occasionally I was handed a cut slip, printed from a second, quieter teletype, which informed the pharmacy when a patient requiring medication had died, so that the order was no longer needed. If a PharmD tapped me on the shoulder and presented me with a cut slip, I stood up, walked to the sink, slashed or cut the bag that I was shooting, and poured it out. And then grabbed a new order on the way back to my chair. One day I got a cut slip for a chemotherapy bag that I was making for a patient whose name I was in the habit of searching out from the pile daily. I stopped and looked around. Somehow I felt I had a simple sort of respects to pay, but who would want them? Slowly I went from believing that I was doing the most important work in the world to ruminating over how pointless it was to be part of a pharmaceutical chain gang producing a mule train of medications to be hauled upstairs every hour of every day forever without end. From this darker perspective, the hospital was a place where you confined a sick person and then pumped medication through him until he died or got better, and it was not more complicated than that. I couldn't cure anybody. I could follow a recipe and wait to see what happened. Just as I reached the peak of my disenchantment, one of my professors offered me a long-term work-study position in his research laboratory, and all at once I was assured of the money that I needed to keep me in college until I got my degree. So I quit my hospital job and gave up on saving other people's lives. Instead, I started working in a research laboratory in order to save my own life. To save myself from the fear of having to drop out and from then being bodily foreclosed upon by some boy back home. From the small-town wedding and the children who would follow, who would have grown to hate me as I vented my frustrated ambitions on them. Instead, I would take a long, lonely journey toward adulthood with the dogged faith of the pioneer who has realized that there is no promised land, but still holds out hope that the destination will be someplace better than here. On the same day that I gave my notice to the human resources office at the hospital, I sat through my break with Lydia. While she smoked, she explained to me that I should never buy a Chevrolet because they just wouldn't run reliably for a woman driver. She had always stuck with Fords and had yet to have one completely crap out on her. During a pause, I shared with Lydia that I'd gotten a better paying job and that I was quitting the pharmacy. True, I'd been working in the hospital for barely 6 months, but I had begun to see it clearly for what it was. This place was a hellhole, I had realized, just as she had been telling me since the first day I met her. I augured grandly that someday I would have my own research lab that would be even bigger than the one I was leaving for, and I wouldn't hire anyone who didn't care as deeply about the work as I did myself. I completed my speech in a little crescendo of self-importance from Chapter 10. It was inevitable that I would be working with a better heart in my own house than I could in anybody else's now. I knew that she had heard me, and so I was surprised when she just looked away and took a drag on her cigarette instead of responding. After a moment, she tapped the ash off and continued talking about cars, picking up exactly where she had left off. After we both got off work at 11 p.m., I waited around for a bit, but then started toward my apartment on foot. It was a clear night and so cold that the snow squeaked underneath my feet as I walked. After I had gone a few blocks, Lydia's car passed me while I was trudging along, and I was stung with a new type of loneliness. The old unhappy loss or want of something had, I am conscious, some place in my heart, came to me from Chapter 44. I watched Lydia's single functioning taillight disappear across the bridge, lowered my head against the wind, and continued to make my own way home. Chapter 5. No risk is more terrifying than that taken by the first root. A lucky root will eventually find water, but its first job is to anchor an embryo and forever end its mobile phase, however passive that mobility was. Once the first root is extended, the plant will never again enjoy any hope, however feeble, of relocating to a place less cold, less dry, less dangerous. Indeed, it will face frost, drought, and greedy jaws without any possibility of flight. The tiny rootlet has only one chance to guess what the future years, decades, even centuries will bring to the patch of soil where it sits. It assesses the light and humidity of the moment, refers to its programming, and quite literally takes the plunge. Everything is risked in that one moment when the first cells, the hypocotyl, advance from the seed coat. The root grows down before the shoot grows up, and so there is no possibility for green tissue to make new food for several days or even weeks. Rooting exhausts the very last reserves of the seed. The gamble is everything, and losing means death. The odds are more than 1,000,000 to 1 against success. But when it wins big. If a root finds what it needs, it bulks into a taproot, an anchor that can swell and split bedrock, and move gallons of water daily for years. Much more efficiently than any mechanical pump yet invented by man. The taproot sends out lateral roots that intertwine with those of the plant next to it, capable of signaling danger, similar to the way that information passes between neurons via their synapses. The surface area of this root system is easily 100 times greater than that of all the leaves put together. Tear apart everything above ground, everything, and most plants can still grow rebelliously back from just one intact root. More than once. More than twice. The deepest growing roots are those of the gutsy acacia tree, genus Acacia. When the Suez Canal was first dug, the thorny roots of a scrappy little acacia tree were found extending 12 meters, 40 feet, or 30 meters downward, depending on whether you are reading Thomas, 2000, Skeen, 2006, or Raven et al., 2005, respectively. I suspect that the authors of these botany textbooks included the Suez Canal anecdote in order to teach me something about hydraulics. But the story has left me with a dank and dusky false memory instead. In my mind, it is 1860, and I see a ragged cohort of men stumble upon a living root while they are digging more than 100 feet below ground. I see them stand gaping in the fetid air, slowly